The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, recorded on August 11th, 2002, in Wicklow, Ireland.
Today we're going to have a class on poetry. We've been having some classes on art. To just have a poetry reading usually tends to be boring, to read from a book, poem after poem after poem. So I try to think of how to make this a little more interesting. One thing is to read from different poets. I'm going to do that. I'll make some comments in between poets. But also I want to, in the beginning, explain a little about the importance of poetry. Poetry books don't sell very much compared to all other kinds of books, including novels. So poetry appreciation is not very high. But it's very important because through poetry things can be expressed that can't be expressed in other ways. And it can capture moments and speak to the heart very directly by the sensitive perception of the poet. That is, the poet is a very sensitive person who perceives things that other people miss, but which are important for everybody. And when the other person gets it from the poet, it can be very important to them for their life. The poet also has a gift of language and can express things in different kinds of rhythms and word choices that are very appealing to the ear and this makes it very special. And it's usually spoken or written with an intensity that's not in other forms of literature. There's a line about poetry that I've read sometimes at poetry readings. From a poem by William Carlos Williams, American poet. He died around 1960s. And when he was very, very old, he wrote a love poem to his wife, he was married only, one wife only, for his lifetime. And he wrote her a poem. And so he was speaking to her directly, but talking about other things in general. He says, "My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many men. Look at what passes for the new. You will not find it there, but in despised poems." So he uses this word despised, meaning that this is the general opinion of poems, and poems are despised, they're not liked. But he says, really new things are found in despised poems. I want to bring you something, because he, out of his love, he wants to bring her something new. Look at what passes for the new. You will not find it there, but you will find it in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems. Where do we usually get the news? We get it from the media, a big word always used now, media, television, newspapers, so forth. You will not find it there, but in despised poems you'll get the news. It is difficult to get the news from poems. Yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Hear me out, for I too am concerned, and every man who wants to die at peace in his bed besides. So what you can learn in poems, he's saying, is is so important. It's a kind of news or a kind of truth without which, he states so strongly, people die leading the ordinary life of consuming, doing mundane things. So I have brought some of my... I intended to bring some of my poems, but I forgot them. That's what Baladeva was going back to see. So I may get cheated of reading my own poems. Quickly, I'll read some Vaishnava poems so that we can taste the direct Vaishnava. It's unfortunate, however, that these are translated because they kind of turn into prose. These are, I'm just reading two Bengali songs by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. These were sent to me by a devotee who keeps them like in a little folder for herself, a Srimati of Mayapur. And collection of favorites, she calls it. It's kind of nice to have your own little favorite collection of poems that you read. She said she reads these every day in an attempt to keep herself humble. So I'm just reading from Sarnagati, Atma Nivedana, Song 3. Mind, body, and family, whatever may be mine, I have surrendered at your lotus feet, O youthful son of Nanda. In good fortune or in bad, in life or at death, all my difficulties have disappeared by choosing those feet of yours as my only shelter. Slay me or protect me as you wish, for you are the master of your eternal servant. If it is yours will that I be born again, then let it be in the home of your devotee. May I be born again even as a worm, so long as I may remain your devotee. I have no desire to be born as a brahmana averse to you. I yearn for the company of that devotee who is completely devoid of all desire for worldly enjoyment or liberation. Father, mother, lover, son, lord, preceptor, and husband, you are everything to me. Thakur Bhaktivinoda says, O Kana, please hear me. O Lord of Radha, you are my life and soul. And last, Atma Nivedana, Song 4. Whatever is indicated by the words Aham, I, and Mama, mine, I now offer at your lotus feet, O merciful Lord. I no longer consider even myself to be mine, O Lord. Now I am exclusively yours. The soul inhabiting this mortal body has given up the false ego attached to the word I. And now the eternal spiritual sense of being yours has entered his heart. All my possessions, bodies, brothers, friends, and followers, sons, personal belongings, house, and home, all of these are now yours, for I have become your servant. I am but a mere occupant in your house. You are the Lord of the house, and I your most obedient servant. Your happiness is now my only endeavor. Whatever pious or impious acts are performed by me, by mind or deed, are no longer mine, for I am now yours. My desire has become one with yours, for on this day Bhaktivinoda has forgotten any other identity than being that of your servant. So it's complete surrender of the self to Krishna, which is the perfection of life. Life after life. Now I want to do something quite daring for a Krishna conscious class. I wanted to read some poems from a devotee, from a poet who's not a member of our parampara, and not even a Vaishnava, unless you take the word Vaishnava in a very broad sense of follower of God. But the class is a poetry appreciation, and I read that quote in the beginning, what actually I thought was very important, to emphasize how important poetry is to us. So I thought, if I read the most excellent poems that I could find, or that have been written in the world, then that in itself would bring you appreciation of poetry, even if it wasn't like Bhaktivinoda Thakura's poem, directly Gaudiya Vaishnava poetry. So I'm going to read you a batch of poems written by Emily Dickinson, who's an American poet, lived around the 1860s in America. And more and more as her reputation rises, the one prominent American poet who was for a few years the poet laureate of America said that of her poems, here's her complete poetry. She wrote 1,775 poems. He said that out of these poems, about, I forget the exact number, but he said about 1,200 of them are the best poems ever written in the world. That's quite a monopoly for one person. She also wrote 1,000 letters. Since we're talking about her, I can tell you a little more about her. She lived in Amherst, Massachusetts. It's in New England, northeast part. And she was a celibate her whole life. But she lived in a busy household, so she wasn't a complete recluse. She was always dealing with her family members, but she never went out of the house, hardly ever. But she was completely devoted to being a poet. However, she only published about 20 poems in her life. And she used to write her poetry privately, and then she'd keep them in her apron, write them during the day, and then at night she would sew them together in little packets and keep them in her drawer. And she just wrote them for the sake of writing them. She once wrote to a famous publisher sent him a few poems and asked him did she think that these poems were alive? Did they live? And he wrote back and he said that there are some lovely lines in these poems, but they're too delicate to be published. He didn't think they're worth being published. There was something too delicate about them. So she said, "Oh, I blush." She wrote back and she said, "I blush to think that you thought I wanted them to be published. I asked if they were alive." She said, she wasn't intending for her poems to be published, so she said, I will continue to be a barefoot poet. So she did not write for, she later wrote in another poem, "A publication is the auction of the mind," and just wrote for her own a sense of self-expression. So I'm reading this from a small collection of favorite poems by another writer. And we'll see if you can see if you like them. Emily Dickinson's own definition of what poetry was, she wrote, this lady who collected these poems, her name is Joyce Carol Oates. She's a very famous novelist in America nowadays. And she so much loves Dickinson, she says, certain of Dickinson's poems are very likely more deeply imprinted in my soul than they were ever imprinted in the poet's. And inevitably they reside more deeply and more mysteriously than much of my own work. For the writer is, as in Dickinson's poet persona suggests, a creature forever in motion, calculating and breathless at once, casting out demons, joy, gems, profundity, in skeins of language, then moving restlessly on. Her work, if it endures at all, can only endure, in Auden's striking phrase, in the guts of the living. So a poet can be so effective that it lives, or the poems live in another person more than in the poet who wrote them. That's how important it can be to us. And what was Dickinson's definition of poetry? She said, if I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only ways I know it. There is no other way. Feel the top of your head is taken off. She rhymed her poetries, and she half-rhymed her poetry. Success is counted sweetest by those who never succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst, agonized and clear. That last paragraph is the definition, is description of a dying soldier who he tastes victory more than anyone else. He didn't get it. And the person who didn't succeed tastes success more than anybody else. Here's a famous poet of hers, a poem of hers. I taste a liquor never brewed from tankards scooped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, how's that for an image? It's just describing the foxgloves like a pub, and the landlords are kicking the bee out. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more, till seraphs swing their snowy hats, and saints to windows run to see the little tippler from Manzanilla come. So as a celibate chaste girl, she's nevertheless describing herself as a drunkard, a wild inebriate of dew. But she drinks the dew. She drinks all these things of nature, which make you far more drunker and intoxicated than these things that men have created. Now here's a poem I'm reading that's it describes something very subtle, but we all experience it. That's why I was saying poets capture things that we don't ordinarily see. We're running here and there into our cars and taking care of business, but if we can see these subtle occurrences in life, it really enriches our life. So see if you can understand what she's describing here. There's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may reach it, any, till 'tis the seal, despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. All she's talking about is a certain slant of light that comes on winter afternoons, but she's saying that all these things it brings up out of the soul, all these feelings. So an ordinary mundaner is going to miss this. But if a person reads poetry, they'll start to see these things in the slant of the winter air. Here's one I've read a number of times at gatherings. It kind of describes her, and it makes fun of the attempt to be a big shot in the world. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell, they'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell your name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog. And this is a very wonderful poem about how individuals, we talk about friendship and picking out friends, and somebody feels they don't have enough friends, and what is really friendship, and what are soulmates, and so on, are all kind of described in this. She's very well known for her one-liners, usually the first line. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door to her divine majority. Present no more. Unmoved, she notes the chariots pausing at her low gate. Unmoved, an emperor may be kneeling upon her mat. I've known her from an ample nation. Choose one, then close the valves of her attention like stone. So she's saying that a person may just select one person, and nobody else. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me, the simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. It also sounds like Emily Dickinson herself. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. And here's a kind of incredible poem describing something that really nobody could describe. Again, a first liner that's like a knockout. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air, between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm from that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. It's an attempt to describe what happens at death and after death. I had been hungry all the years. My noon had come to dine. I trembling drew the table near and touched the curious wine. 'Twas on this tables I had seen, when turning hungry home, I looked in windows for the wealth I could not hope for mine. I did not know the ample bread. 'Twas so unlike the crumb the birds and I had often shared in nature's dining room. But now she's going to describe that now she's inside, now she's getting it. All these years she was just like a bird outside and could never enjoy and taste what everyone was getting. And now she describes, the plenty hurt me, was so new. Myself felt ill and odd, as berry of a mountain bush transplanted to the road, nor was I hungry. So I found that hunger was a way of persons outside windows. The entering takes away. She'd rather not have that indoors. I stepped from plank to plank, a slow and cautious way. The stars about my head I felt, about my feet the sea. I knew not, but the next would be my final inch. This gave me that precarious gait some call experience. But that's how we live. As we say in the Shastra, there's danger at every step. So our experience is like that. We never know as we walk from plank to plank if suddenly there'll be a plank missing and that the next step will be the final inch. She says, this is called experience. If you're alive to life, that's what experience is, not knowing. And then I'll read just one more. The bustle in a house the morning after death is solemnness of industries enacted upon earth, the sweeping up the heart and putting love away we shall not want to use again until eternity. She casts a spell. And just think how different than today. Somebody only does something because they want to become a success. She was just doing it like a nun or something out of dedication to the art itself, writing these poems during the day and sewing them into little packets at night. And when she died, her sister found them all in the drawer. Her sister was so impressed by them that she printed a little book and immediately it became a bestseller and people bought it. Then some decades later, she took some more of the poems and printed them, and they sold right away, too. And then they did it again. And then finally, in 1950, they took all the poems, published her complete poems. Also, she wrote in a queer way. She didn't write in periods. She would put dashes at the end of her lines, and she wouldn't put proper rhymes. So the first people who edited, quote, corrected, unquote, all these mistakes. They took the dashes out. They put periods in. They changed all her idiosyncrasies. And later, more intelligent editors said, hey, this is a genius. This is the way she writes. Put it back the way she wrote it. And now her poems are all the way she originally wrote them with their strange dashes and their strange half rhymes and so on. Now I have some of my poems, and I have some of poems from DOV. My only fear of this program is that when I finish and read the DOV poems, the whole program is going to end in envy, because some devotees are going to say, he didn't read my poem. But I rather quickly... I didn't prepare well in advance, and only this morning I went through the a pile of DOVs and picked out some ones I liked. So ones that were very long I didn't pick, and just ones that caught my eye. Actually, some of my favorites I perhaps didn't pick out. So please don't be envious if I don't read yours. This is a poem, a little book. I don't even know if you know this one or have seen it. Talking Freely to My Lords. A little book I wrote just after Kartik, as Kartik was ending, but in Gita Nagari. And it's about life at Kitanagari, trying to capture the woodsy feeling there. And it's got beautiful drawn pictures by a devotee who lived there at that time. So here's one of the poems. It has a nice illustration of two cows in a barn. I have been hearing from devotees in Vrindavan that unless I go there, I can't feel anything. Quote, you have to get the mercy directly. The dirt in any room in Vrindavan is conscious, not like the dirt in the West. One grain can fulfill all your desires, unquote. But aren't Lalita and Vishakha their most intimate friends? They have murtis of Lalita and Vishakha there. Isn't Radha's smile right here? Can't I come to Braja with Damodar? If it's easier for people like me to walk through autumn leaves in boots, if we'd like to eat prasadam with brown Swiss ghee, and if we feel comfortable here, is that to be held against us? I'll go to India, but I'm just saying, Krishna is here. This is a beautiful picture of a bend of the Tuscarora Creek with the sunshine, sort of like in the afternoon. I just remembered a poem a young devotee wrote about 22 years ago. Her name was Hemavati. And the poem went like this. The forest is calling me, but I prefer to stay indoors washing Krishna's dishes. Watching the leaf boats around the bend of Tuscarora Creek, long columns of reflected tree trunks. The wind is up, last leaves fallen, but I prefer to write Prabhupada meditations. It's called meager resources, gunshots, loud, and more of them. So much trouble in each life. And me with meager resources. A disciple wrote me, you tell us to follow the rules, but we need to be hugged. Your philosophy doesn't grow corn and run oxen. People hurt us and play games. So what are you going to do? We don't see you as the one who can heal. I go out the back door into the woods, come back healed, but not enough. Who can help the deer? Okay, let me start reading some of these. This has been a favorite of mine. It's by Ishani. It's called The Price. And it starts out, it says, to be read fast. So you've got a meeting, some phone calls to make, and then some calls to take, an important discussion, more rounds to chant, reading to do, Gayatri true, then someone to see, money to make and risks to take for Krishna. So you've got to take a nap, have a shower, have a crap. See yet another man and yet another dog, a wench about a loan, top brass about a grant. You've got a boat to mend, you've got money to lend and plans to expend for Krishna. You're such a busy man. It's getting out of hand. It's always was this way, the price you have to pay for someone in the know and always on the go. You're playing out that role, but it will take its toll. And what about your soul? Please don't forget the goal is Krishna. Slow down here. P.S. And there's, of course, your wife, your trouble and your strife, who also gave her life to you and Krishna. There's another by Ishani. The light is on in Rupa Goswami's Samadhi. The light is on in Rupa Goswami's Samadhi, and I think of Prabhupada in his rooms at Radha Damodar. Looking out through those latticed windows, thinking of the past acharyas, and wondering how to spread Krishna consciousness to English-speaking countries. The light is on in Rupa Goswami's Samadhi. That same light has just attracted a moth. Round and round he flies mindlessly, only falling stunned to the ground when he can take no more of it, but still helplessly attracted by Maya's dazzling glare. The light is on in Rupa Goswami's Samadhi. One reasons ill who say that Vaishnavas die. The great saint is still home here in Vrindavan, eternally part of Krishna's pastimes, a stone throw from Prabhupada in Parampara, most mercifully saving moth-like creatures like me. Here's one by Abhaya Dasi. The Japa dance, waltzing across the room and back again. Who is my partner? I am, says the black shadow. I am, says the beautiful boy. He stands so sweetly, flute to lips, waiting. But the shadow's in the way. He is always with me. When I raise my hand, so does he. Wherever I move, he's there. Before me, larger than me, blacker than me, stronger than me. He tells me I can't leave him, because I chose him. And so I dance and cry inside of my true love, imprisoned by my shadow love. Here's one by Radhanath Das. Waning moon, 2 days. How to put it into words? She told me I should go back to Krishna and pray to him to become more humble. She was right. I twinged as we laughed, wondering what would happen to induce such a desire on my part. Pray for humility? But that's like asking for difficulty, I thought. Already my day has not gone as I planned. Surely this is suffering enough. Unfortunately not. I gambled that the petrol would get me home, too stingy to spend the money on more. It didn't. Stuck on the road to Gaglam's Cay. A mile walk home, 2 rounds to chant in a cold and blustery night. I fingered my beads in anticipation of Sukha's greeting. Fiercely hungry without a meal since breakfast. The darkness of night closing in. Rarely did I hear Krishna's name. No time for that. Got things to think of, problems to solve. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I've had a rough day. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Can I show it my face without saying it? Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Let her have compassion on this tired, hungry fool. Rama, Rama, Hare Hare. I want nurturing. Decision made. No Maha Hare Nama for me. Got too much to do. Craft shows, my service, blow glass, lots of it. Hot kitchery and bread. It fills the belly and warms the bones. Grateful for that. Hiking back out to the van with petrol in the jug. Let's be done with it. Petrol in tank. Won't start. Car's at the wrong angle. Petrol can't get to engine. And then he has that, you know, when you want to have a string of curses, if you just put stars, exclamation, money mark, this and that. Rather than saying the curses. Walk to Wilson's. Maybe it's a good time to pray to Krishna. Put down the beads, like background noise. I come here tonight for your darshan. It's not much, but it's all I can do right now in a direct link to you. I want to tell you about a great experience today. No, that was a skip the page. Think of him. I am not the controller. Damn, how I so much think I am. He is making it all a farce when I forget him. Now it is time. Now I am taking the time to see. Let me be a humble person. I want to be a humble person and a friend to all living beings. Moments of prayer, groping for sincerity, coming up dry but pushing on with the attempt. This is a virtuous thing. Push on, even if it sounds silly. Find footing and become closer at heart to the desire to be his servant. Wilson agreed. Pushed us till it started. Quote Subhadra, unquote, on the road again. Bright yellow, put, put, put. I thank Wilson and look up to see the waning moon pulling away from a cloud like Krishna's effulgence amidst the demon of doubt. The tape came on. Guru Maharaj telling us of Srila Prabhupada's awareness of Krishna, taking it all away from him before he became vanaprastha and sannyas. It all fits. Krishna is shining in our lives, gently helping us to see him as he takes our material attachments from our stubborn grasp. Just another day in the holy Dham, never take it for granted. Please, Lord, never let me take it for granted. And when I do, please let me be encouraged to become humble again. And one day let it stick to my habits. Simple humility. Any questions or comments about poetry? I got a lot more here. Yeah.
in Emily Dickinson's poem about bread and crumbs. She
yeah.
Crumbs and she got the bread. Is that a metaphor, do you think?
She was describing herself as being outside. And then when she finally got inside, she didn't like it. Sounded like she didn't really want to. She wasn't a material enjoyer, and the things that people think are so wonderful—the wine and the bread on the table and everything. Once you get to them, a person like her found that she'd rather be on the outside with the birds, like a renunciate. Yeah?
At least when I was in school, you were taught that poets are those who have a lot of passions and experiences in life, and then they record it in a poetic form. And sometimes you hear, at least at the moment, I'm hearing, well, if somebody has a certain type of psychological composure, say he's a schizoid type, and he'll really be thinking about details which are normally people wouldn't pick up, and then he would be the poet. But is it like any regular Joe can be a poet for himself, or is it kind of selected few who can be poets?
Any regular Joe can be anything if he puts himself to it, you know. You just can't pick up a violin and become a great violin player, but if you at an early age decide you want to be and you practice and practice and practice, it depends also. There's something called God-given talent. And but it's not just any old writing is poetry. So it takes special gifts and practice and I would say talent too. So but it's not an exclusive club. If somebody really wants to do something, then God will allow them to do it. They don't have to have, like he was saying, something that's schizoid. Did you say?
It's not a type. Yeah.
No, it's not a pathological type of person. There are so many different poets, right? There's Robert Frost. He's just a country farmer. And then there's Edgar Allan Poe, who is like a inverted, strange, psychological type. And then there's somebody who loves nature, and somebody who has a very expansive view of heaven and hell, and writes a theological poem like John Milton or something. So there are all kinds of different psychological types. Or somebody who's very, like you say, passionate, to get a lot of worldly experience, like in America, the beat poets, Allen Ginsberg, and writing down all the things that happen in their immoral lives, or political poets. So it's not just a psychological type of person who's a poet. And here's Emily Dickinson, a woman who stayed up in her attic and never went out. So there's all kinds of people can be poets. William David Thoreau wrote something about, he said it's the ability to perceive. He said a captain at sea doesn't have more experience necessarily than a woman at home who's just using her thimble and a needle and is sewing. It depends on the ability of the eye to be sensitive and see things. He may be experiencing so many wild adventures, but he's not seeing as much as she's seeing. You just look outside and see the flowers, and a sensitive person can just like she says, I'm an inebriate of dew. See simple things and be a poet. Yeah.
Someone said what it means to be a poet as far as a devotee is concerned is one of the qualities of a devotee, to be a poet.
Yeah.
And there were, I used to think, well, I can't write rhymes, I'm not a devotee. But actually, it seems like you're saying it is to be very, you know, to be perceptive and introspective and be able to articulate, that would be helpful. And you know.
I heard Prabhupada say a couple of things about that. Once he said, he was listing those 26 qualities, and he said, poet. He said, all the acharyas were poets. He said, they wrote, they've all written beautiful poetry. So that would suggest that they actually are rhymers or writers of poetry. But another time he said, poet, and he said, I can't remember the words, he says, not exactly poet, like he's a writer of verse, but he's kavi. The word for poet is kavi. He's learned, and he's, he would be, whether he wrote poems down or not, he would be a very sensitive appreciator of the affairs of Radha and Krishna, and not be dull. Prabhupada used to say, don't be dull. And when he went to Vrindavan, he would appreciate it, or he would appreciate hearing about things. So that quality of poet wouldn't necessarily, he means he's, you know that expression, they say Joe Sixpack in America, the ordinary guy, he just opens a can of beer and watches television. So there's no poetry in his soul. He's just goes to work and comes home and just wasting his life. Whereas devotee is a poet. He's worshiping his deities. He's chanting. He's trying to think of Krishna. He's not a slob. Cares for other people. Abhayadasi, a moment with my deities. A hurried lunch after a long trip to the homeopathic doctor in Tyrone. Quickly placed the offerings on the plates. Briskly said the prayers. Then head to the ground. I offered obeisances, but I didn't pop back up again and into action. I stayed head on the ground in that humble pose before the deities. Be still and know that I am God. This refrain plays again and again in my brain. Be still, listen. I hear the pounding of my heart and the wind howling round the house, cries of the children at play, and the sizzle of oil in the chip pan. I enter into the peaceful aura that surrounds the deities on the altar, silent witnesses to all my frantic activities. I stay still, head on the ground, and hold on to this precious moment. So this is like almost missing the poetic moment, rushing through life without looking at all these things, and then suddenly realizing that the poetic moment is here, or the religious moment is here. And so we save our mundane life and become poetic. Some people see it more than others. You can imagine a person who sees it all the time, it would be almost too much to bear. But a person who never sees it is like a robot. I love that line in the Emily Dickinson poem. She says there is a certain slant of light in the evening at winter, and then she conjures up all these things that it brings to mind, finally death. But just from, you know, a certain thing that you see. And here Abhay caught herself in her busyness and stayed with the moment. Here's, I would say, a cute one by Gopakana about baby Krishna. Maybe he's got a a baby Krishna deity or something. He's got an attraction for baby Krishna. I got you, babe, a wonderful infant, newborn child, not of this world, diminutive, quote, little, unquote, form, mini incarnation, maxi person, miniature beautiful, a sense of the terrific. He's small, tiny, wee, just a minute. He's not a minute. I want to molly, coddle, dear Krishna, over, indulge, and humor him, pamper and pet. I can't spoil you. May I spoon feed you? It's really in the Vatsalya mood there. Here's one Vegavati, an experience she had at Radhakund. It wasn't a fall so much as a slip. Trying to reach past the algae to fill my flask, I ended up chest high in sweet Radhakund, dripping blissfully to the bus, greeted by my kindly Gurudev, who said affectionately, "We almost left without you." We usually go until about now, so I don't want to read all the rest I have. Or I can stay a little longer. Who's Suniti Dasi?
Oh.
It's got a nice childish feeling, a childlike feeling to it. Goloka Vrindavan is where I want to be because that is the place where I can see Radha Gopinath. Radha Gopinath, their lordships, and their loving nectar, I'll take my dip. So take me back there, Srila Prabhupada, where I can be happy, where I can be glad. Of course, this book is now dormant. If anybody wants to start it up again, lack of interest in it, and I think some of the politics among the editors just what made it dead. But you can see it's nice. Oh, speaking of that, here's one from Uddhava. There was one from Uddhava. There was one about how you were cynical about the magazine and then it came out. I had it chosen, but it says thank you, but it's not there. This isn't it. A little too long to read, but a nice one by Manu, the art gallery, how they went to the art gallery and it was all artificial, but when they got outside the art gallery, then he and his children were playing with all the natural birds, and it was beautiful. I thought it was a beautiful poem, how he contrasted the artificiality of the art in the museum with the natural beauty of playing with the birds. Here's a nice one, Anandamayi Dasi. Geglam dawn, the trees silhouetted against a myriad of color, harsh black stretching with uplifted arms, bleak cold dawn, the vapor of my breath rushes out in the greeting, Jai Hari Bol, to a Prabhu walking by. The darkness of black highlighted by the fusion of dawn's light, dark blue, deep blue, turquoise, green, yellow dawn. This black is not true darkness. True darkness is ignorance of the Supreme. A darkened soul, memories of D. Gray's picture. This is not real black. Real black is the color of Govinda, waiting to see us dance on the island. These are not real colors. The blue is not the blue of Krishna, a cowherd in Vrindavan's dawn. Blacks, blues, and splendid colors, Govinda with his face painted. With a fresh intake of cold air, I breathe a sigh of contentment. This is a beautiful dawn. Krishna has given to us so much beauty. If we can appreciate, perhaps someday I will see the real beauty of pure spiritual life. For today, I'll chant in the dawn. It really captures Gagam at that hour. And I'll finish with one from Rough and Ready, Aniruddha Das. Seen on the site. He fills the kettle in the toilet cold, bath tap full of concrete grit, flips on the switch to boil and parks his arse on a bag of cement, takes in a noon Gayatri background music ring from the lovely thatch, hammers an empty drum of mortar, plaster, sizer, makes the muck easier to spread. With a couple of lumps of broken block, rhythmically clunk, cleaning out a rotating mixer, builders, tea bags now, wear a beard on the floor, friend fires turf in a wriggly tin shed. The Great Wall of China went a little higher and longer. Through the opening, view the corpse. S, shouts another, means he bashed his thumb with aerodynamic hammer again, wipes hands on jeans, tears open a bread bun, leaves finger marks in the butter, spreads honey with the cleanest screwdriver he can find. Yeah, well, it gets rough on sight. Still, he calls himself a Brahmin. So read our Vaishnava poetry in translation from Sanskrit and Bengali, and read poetry of devotees in our languages. Sometimes you can read great poetry, great poets who may not be Vaishnavas, to see how great poetry can be. And it'll increase your sensitivity to life in this world, and increase your Krishna consciousness. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.